Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Monday, June 1st. May did not fly by. May kind of crawl by, but that means the off season is two-thirds of the way done, guys. I am Tim O'Malley, joined by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, Pete Sampson of The Athletic. And after a good run, Notre Dame's spring sports season has ended. We talked about lacrosse losing to Princeton last week. Baseball, we'll get a little postmortem from baseball here after the break from Tim Priester. But guys, I wanted to jump into football because, Priester, you did your annual, you said 16th annual, first-rate series. Always a good time to start with the quarterbacks, especially this year, because for the first time, we have verified this, Notre Dame is number one in your quarterback list, and it's because they have a what we perceive to be a great quarterback, and B, he only has a couple competitors.
Yeah, really just a small handful of competitors to Darian Mensah from Duke. Now with Miami, I mean, you could make an argument for him just because of the volume last year, but, you know, I mean, you have... It's a balancing act. You have to juggle what they did last year and try to project what they're going to do this year. And I think, you know, I put CJ Carr ahead of Darian Mensah, and I would have put Mensah ahead of Carr if I felt like he deserved it. But the deciding factor for me is the ceiling for CJ Carr, whereas I think Darian Mensah may be at his ceiling. Mm-hmm. We'll see how his career develops this year and then moving on to the next level. But yeah. CJ Carr and Notre Dame's quarterback situation, or CJ Carr, I should say, is the reason why we have Notre Dame number one, and I don't think too many people would dispute that.
Where'd you have Jaden Maiava?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It was weird going through this that you see USC and your first reaction is to grab that stat and write it down, but you're skipping over that this year. But where would he have been? He would have been right there with Mensah.
Yeah, I think I put Maiava over Mensah.
I think I would too. You know, Mensah he's not a runner.
Yeah.
They both turn it over a lot.
Yeah.
Mensah lost eight fumbles in addition to double.
That's bullsiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Well, and he attempted 500 passes, so he dropped back, yeah. You know, he threw more than 200 passes than CJ Carr. So, you know, a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison there. You know, had Mensah been a runner, you know, a guy that you can count on for running consistently, I might have considered him for number one.
Before we move on from the first rate series, Priester, who is next for a little teaser for our Irish Illustrated subscribers position group?
Oh, first rate. I'm doing running backs. I'm not there yet. It's probably going to be a few days before.
A little tougher running backs than it was last year because you could rate.
Well, pretty quickly. Yeah, you know, so Notre Dame's probably not going to be extremely high because of the inexperience. Although I think we all have a lot of confidence in Neas Williams as lead running back. But no, Notre Dame will not be at the top of that list. There's, you know, running back from BYU is the leading returning rusher on Notre Dame's schedule. So I would imagine BYU will be right up there at the top.
Pete Sampson, we were joking before the segment here about Steve Sarkisian believes in an 11-team playoff. Would you like to explain that to our listeners?
No, because I can't really understand it. Yeah, it's only June 1st, and I feel like I'm already sick of conference meetings.
Yeah, it started
roll
like
around, my head's going to explode.
College football started 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like it? Like the offseason has been truncated here this year.
Yeah, it's like you got Texas Tech willing to buy out Texas State and Abilene Christian so we can get a Texas Tech-Texas game in week one as if Texas is going to open the season with Texas Tech and Ohio State back-to-back. I mean, we've reached those obnoxious levels of posturing and grandstanding, but that's the sport that we know and love.
When the season ends in November, it is a very, very long offseason.
Yes, that's for sure. Yeah, and just to clarify, Steve Sarkisian had mentioned, for those who are not, hopefully not paying attention to the offseason SEC meetings or anybody else, that Notre Dame gets a free spot because if they're in the top 12, as if getting into the top 12 was not earned by at least 10, if not 11 wins this season. And I think most people believe that top 12 teams should be in the tournament, unless your name is James Madison or someone else.
Yeah, I don't think it's a real everything involving Notre Dame ultimately ends up being controversial, whether it actually is or not.
Yeah, I think Bryce made a good point a few podcasts ago saying the off-season storyline or the in-season storyline is going to be Notre Dame is going to be talked about every time somebody brings something up because of the not being in the playoff last year, weak early schedule, and how they compared to everybody else. It's just going to be a constant. You're going to be watching Georgia Tech play Duke, and they're going to mention Notre Dame's schedule. It's going to be a constant harping.
Remember when Notre Dame was likable 2 years ago, yes. Like nationally?
They were for about
Penn State game peaked, right?
That faced an untimely demise last December and has not recovered.
They were popular up to a point. I'm telling you, there would have been the sympathy for Marcus Freeman and Notre Dame had Notre Dame not went on and on about their plight would have been it would have been really, really significant through the playoffs because that because then everybody felt like Notre Dame could win the national title. So yeah, the sympathy lasted for about 48 hours.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tim, because when teams get left out of the NCAA tournament, you forget it by Tuesday. It's Monday. You're like, I can't believe Syracuse didn't get in at number 64. And then you don't care anymore because that team wasn't going to win the title. Notre Dame is a team left out that would have been in the Final Four or title game. You know, if you run into Indiana or Miami, then you have a tough game. Other than that, they were out. That would have been a fun one to see them try to go through it. Also been fun, getting more fun in our countdown because at the beginning it's just all freshman linemen, as Pete Sampson knows well from from years past. We are in the midst of the Irish Illustrated countdown. I wanted to bring this up because we've had a question on that thread for a while. Aiden Pouncey was number 71 on our list this year, and it's because Notre Dame is so deep at corner. Obviously, Aiden Pouncey has nothing to do with talent level or his future, but he... At the average, he was higher ranked than that for some people, but at the average, he was number 71. And we were asked in that thread, Priester, who are the biggest risers in the history of the countdown? And if you think about it, it's actually fairly logical. The biggest risers were Joe Alt, because he was a freshman lineman. Yeah. Benjamin Morrison, because opportunity knocked and he took advantage of it. And then the one guy that we would have ranked higher if we did the countdown on June 1st than April 24th was Leonard Moore. We had heard a lot about Leonard Moore by then.
Yeah.
But those are the guys that made the biggest jumps. Aiden Pouncey seems like the first guy on this list, Pete. And I know you haven't seen the whole list, but it's a lot of linemen and reserve players. Where Aiden Pouncey's like, oh, that guy, he could be higher than that at some point.
Yeah, they've recruited extremely well, and they don't need them to play, which is kind of remarkable. So, I mean, Aiden Pouncey could be higher on the list in 2 years, but next year he could be 62. Like, it, you know, he might not have a chance to move up based on the lack of opportunity, but that's roster building for the haves, which Notre Dame definitely is one of them. And that's good construction of your 85/105. When you kind of Aiden Pouncey as your 71st guy, you're in good shape.
Tim, when we have five guys voting on this and we just take an average, it's not,
right, you know, it's not, average. It's got to be
that's
the average.
That's all is average. I wonder if we should, like, throw out the highest and lowest score.
We used to list the highest and lowest score, but now we just list everybody's score so you can read it yourself. Yeah, I know what you're saying. There's, you know, we don't really have too many outliers. Every once in a while, there'll be someone 17 spots away, and it's just because someone thought of special teams or someone thought of other aspects.
I would challenge it. I would challenge everyone to take the 102 names and you go ahead and rank them preseason. I mean, not preseason. No spring.
Yeah, I could do this. I could do this in August a lot easier.
Right.
It's post spring.
Right. It's really like as a Notre Dame fan, do it, and you'll see. I'm not like saying woe is us. I'm just saying that it's really, really difficult when you're choosing among, you know, a fourth string freshman offensive lineman and a third string freshman DB. It's really, talk about apples and oranges. It's really difficult.
I'm going to drop the countdown talk after this last statement because I texted you this and the rest of the staff, Priester, but Pete, you don't know it. Today is Jack Larson, okay? He's 69, which, you know, that's not important. But think of ranking 102 players, Pete Sampson, all right? Somehow Jack Larson in a five-person poll, Priester, Bentock, Thomas, Willer, O'Malley, this is insane, was ranked 67, 67, 67, 69, and 69.
That's just.
That never happens. I mean, that only happens at 1 and 2, where people say 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. So anyway, I found that interesting. I regret not ranking him 67th, so I could have fallen in line with everybody else. Actually, in the future, I'm just going to change that because I'm in charge of the numbers. I'll just switch him to 67 and nobody will have any idea that I ever did that. It's fudge the numbers all we want. Tim, we want to circle back to baseball. Aerofan624 had a question, and we'll lead with this, but obviously you can give the postmortem of the season. Have you guys heard anything about Sean Stifler being a candidate for any of the Big 12 ACC or SEC openings that will pop up?
Well, first of all, Aerofan624 is the greatest Notre Dame baseball fan in the country.
He has a great post up right now on our board, his own postmortem. I encourage you
to take that one. No, I mean, he's totally into it. I assume the question's a joke, right?
No, I don't think so.
I don't understand why he would be a candidate. I don't understand why he'd be a candidate somewhere else in one of the big the
major conferences. That's why I was leading into your postmortem for the season.
Yeah, I think the bigger news is that and our esteemed colleague Matt Freeman reported that he spoke with Beano Waters, and Beano Waters being one of their two or three best players is going to enter the transfer portal, which is not a surprise. I mean, left-handed hitting guy with some pop. Not a lot of position versatility, but a great left-handed bat. You know, they're going to lose their best players again, I would imagine. Not Quatrani, who has another year of eligibility, but yeah, you know, not a good situation. And that's what now you know how Notre Dame in baseball knows how the group of five schools in football feel. You know, I mean, Notre Dame's baseball wise is kind of down the road a little bit there, and the better teams pick their best players. Carson Tinney, they lost last year to Texas, who would have looked really good in that lineup. Of course, Notre Dame didn't have necessarily a ton of problems with their everyday lineup. It was their pitching staff that just couldn't hold people down. Hey, remember, Tim, when I was asked a question about would they win their first game, the ACC tournament, win their first game, second game or third game, whether the second game was Virginia Tech, I said Virginia Tech had the worst ERA in the ACC. Well, they gave up 10 runs to Notre Dame, but Notre Dame gave up 2 touchdowns and a field goal. So, yeah, they're going to have to – they got to get some things straightened out on the mound.
Pete, you've been on for some of our defensive line recruiting discussion. I think we talked about how they were doing well in the ends, but now defensive tackle is the new frontier that they've crossed. There's kind of a – and it's still coming, I think, as the summer progresses here. But ND Dan 106 had a good question I thought you'd like to start with. Recruiting has taken a significant step forward under Freeman. Offensive line, defensive line, and DB are at elite levels. RB, QB, solid. Wide receiver, linebacker being a bit of a question. After the cycles of Bowen Osbury, Kingston, and Framo, did anyone expect that linebacker recruiting would be looked at as a potential weakness the way wide receiver used to be? I do think they need to put a stamp on linebacker recruiting in this next two cycles.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't put it in the same group as wide receiver. Like, that's a different level of struggle. And, you know, they just haven't had a lot of like tape to show. They're like, hey, this is what our offense can look like. Linebacker is such a non-premium position in the NIL world. I really have little concern that Notre Dame will find a guy or two that will come in and do the job. And like, if they have to go to the portal, they will. So no, is it important? Sure, but it's the least important position on the defense, which is weird to say because we always think about like, hey, linebacker's the quarterback of the defense. Like, well, that may be true, but you need legit dudes at safety, corner, edge, D tackle. So if you're going to have a position where maybe you're not killing it in recruiting on defense, linebacker would be my first choice by a wide margin. So yeah, with Freeman as a head coach, the former linebacker, I guess I don't share ND Dan 106's concern here right now.
Yeah. It will be interesting to see who Notre Dame will be choosing from when they get to that point. I mean, it'll be somebody it'll probably be a real quality linebacker from a, you know, at least mid range to upper level range power four team. So it'll be fun to see that. You know, I think, I mean, you get spoiled with when you have Mike Mickens recruiting your secondary, even when he chooses a 3-star guy, he becomes a 4.5-star.
Yeah.
And now the defensive line, I think Charlie Partridge is, you know, a really attractive level of football coach that defensive linemen want to play for. I think there's some other factors involved there, and Tim, you had mentioned that, you know, I mean, we all love Max Bullo with the job he did with the linebackers, but the recruiting aspect of it,
The coaching aspect of it was very good.
The coaching aspect of it was great, but the recruiting aspect, you know, maybe not so much. So we'll see how it unfolds. But I think it'll be interesting to see. You know, I think you're going to, when they go in the portal for a linebacker and you see the name, you're going to recognize the name. He'll be a prominent defensive player somewhere else.
And of all the guys I always mentioned could leave, because Notre Dame has a really good year if these guys have a good opportunity to move on. Snead has to move on, Bowen as well. Although Bowen could fall into that 5 for 5. He should probably look into the NFL, though, after 4 years of playing linebacker at Notre Dame. But he could fall into 5 for 5. Osbury's the type of guy that the money he could make at Notre Dame would be bigger than he could make in the NFL in his first
year. I don't think it's close.
Yeah, and I'm not saying Jaden Osbury can't go to the NFL and play for 9 years. It's just that the first contract would not be the same thing. So he's kind of an interesting player to watch. And then, of course, Framo will only be a true junior next year. The thing about Kingston Viliamuasa is if he comes back and he's healthy and Notre Dame plays great and makes a run through the playoffs, he could be a first-round pick at linebacker. So we're talking about apples and oranges when you have a guy like Kingston and Osbury, who would both be hugely valuable for Notre Dame next year. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. First question is from Nicodemus. Forever, I have had a pretty clear picture of what criteria was sought for each position on the field. For example, I used to know what an offensive tackle looked like, what a guard looks like, in contrast. Now Freeman and staff have seemingly rethought everything. Is this just a preference Freeman and his coaches have regarding linemen or receivers, etc., that they challenge preconceived notions to build out position groups with fresh eyes, or am I simply reading something into what I see?
I'd go reading something into here, because Knapp is a great case study here, where you think like, oh yeah, maybe a left tackle doesn't need to be 6'8" and 320 pounds like every other left tackle at Notre Dame, going back to Zach Martin. But that we would not be talking about Anthony Knapp if Charles Jagasa didn't get hurt. Yeah. You know, he would have been the left tackle and be like, man, what a prototypical left tackle that is. So I think you're just trying to get the best guys on the field at the various positions. Like, the length of their defensive end recruiting has been a change, but I feel like they're kind of late to the party on that one. Like,
I think it might just be success too.
Yeah. You know, it's successful. Like, stop signing defensive tackles who are 5'11". Like, I think they've always wanted to not sign 5'11" defensive tackles, but they just had a hard time finding guys to say yes. So yeah, I think that Nicodemus, you don't need to overthink this a whole lot. It's just, you don't have a prototype body type at every position every year. And sometimes you look out and be like, are they moving in a different direction here? Is this a trend? And I think this is more one-off than it is trend.
Yeah, I generally agree, Pete. I mean, it is getting your best players on the field. Knapp is this kind of leads us into the next question, right, Tim?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, for example, while we were saying off the air, Will Black, okay, he wasn't going to be needed at tackle last year, but he might be needed at guard, so let's get him reps there. I think it's just all about the best, putting your best players on the field. Like, as it relates to, you know, Caden Finley in the slot. Well, you know, that's, you start to look at a big guy matching up in the slot. Well, maybe we can do something like that. As it relates to the offensive line, in addition to getting your best players on the field, I think maybe Joe Rudolph looks outside the box a little bit more than, say, a Harry Hiestand did. But it's just about, you know, I mean, it's just about where can we gain an advantage with the type of player we put there. I think that's what, when you put a bigger guy in the slot, that's what you do, because we don't expect, like, Greathouse in the slot. Why would they do that? But I think it's a combination of things, but it's predominantly getting your best football players on the field.
And sometimes I think at wide receiver, I'll go back a couple of years when Jaden Thomas was a slot. They just needed more good players at the position. Yep. If you were to throw out a wide receiver group of Fuller, Tate, Floyd, Samardzija, and Stovall, you could probably see some pigeonhole players playing where they're supposed to be playing at certain times. I don't think they'd be like, we better force Maurice Stovall into the slot position when you had Golden Tate and TJ Jones sitting there. I do think receiver recruiting necessitated it, and maybe even modern football. I mean, they should be moving around. You're moving fast, right? There's many things you can do with a versatile receiver in the slot or on the field side. Related question, as Priester said, from Chris Scheiber. Of the two big moves on the OL, whose physical skills translate better to their new position? Knapp at guard or Lambert at tackle?
Yeah, I would say Knapp at guard, because I think Lambert could play either position in the NFL. I really do. I mean, I love the way he looked at guard last year. It'll be interesting to see his transition to offensive tackle. I think it's going to be mostly seamless, but it was eye-opening, wasn't it, Tim, last year about how good, like, I don't think we expected him to look like an NFL guard. And as the season progressed, I thought he was, you know, trending in that direction. Whereas Knapp is not the prototypical, you know, tackle edge guy. He's more of a interior guy. We'll see if he plays it as well as he played. I mean, for a guy that you say is a little bit undersized and isn't, and wouldn't have been in that position had Jagerson not gotten hurt, he did pretty damn well. He's just a good football player, and that's why he doesn't care what position he plays.
I think Knapp, 10 out of 10 would be my answer for him. I think he's going to have a great year. I think he's the best offensive lineman they have in the starting lineup. Is he the best pro prospect? Maybe not, but I think he's going to be by far the best college offensive lineman on Notre Dame's roster.
I like this question because, like you, Tim, I really liked what Lambert started to show at guard last year. We were at the beginning of the year, you're like, wow, that is a strange one. But then we just thought, well, they want to get him on the field. That makes total sense. You were taking Emil Wagner off the field, and you weren't going to throw him out at left tackle freshly in Miami either, Kirby Lambert. But he certainly has the prototype for right tackle, and if he can do it, then you've opened up so many avenues at guard that maybe Charles Jagasek can come back and play right guard like he did at a high level against Penn State. And then all of a sudden, you're off and running into the final six games of the season, as opposed to six games including the playoffs. I think you're absolutely right. Joe Rudolph looks to put, more than other people, seems to look to put his best ones out there. I guess I shouldn't say that because they had so many guys get hurt, but to me it seems like Joe Rudolph now might have learned, like, hey, I can move some guys around and make this work out.
Even and attack and at left and right tackle too, where you think more prototype strong side right tackle. You know, he's open-minded about that. I think it's good. I think it's part of the evolution of the game that Joe Rudolph has built.
Michael Kolitz sent us a good question on Twitter, but I eliminated one because I did not find it plausible. So, which of the following scenarios seem plausible at the start of the season? A, we have vastly underestimated the loss of Love and Price, and ND's ground game suffers to a degree that more than you have forecasted. B, the offensive line lacks some cohesion due to missing players from injury, and CJ Carr is too often placed in jeopardy. Or C, Chris Ash's criticism of scheme resurfaces as it was last year. The other one had to do with Carr, and I was not going to entertain that.
Are we ranking these most plausible to least plausible?
Yeah, what's the most plausible thing that all of a sudden people are a little mad about when the Rams?
I think most plausible is the offensive line lacks cohesion, followed by the running back. Big gap, and then Chris Ash as the least plausible.
That's exactly the way I see it. Exactly what I said. I am not concerned in the least of Chris Ash's defensive scheme. What happened last year was I mean, you can point the finger at Ash. He's responsible, what have you. But it was the teams that they were playing. It was the first two games that he was coaching as defensive coordinator at Notre Dame. I think, I agree with B as number one, but I don't necessarily think that CJ Carr is going to be placed in jeopardy. He was only sacked 12 times last year. And again, I realize that things have been shuffled up front. I don't think that's going to be an issue. I think it would be more short yardage stuff that might not be as consistent. But the least concern by far is Chris Ash's defense. And if you saw some of the people reacted to our first-rate story on the quarterbacks and some of the information in there, Notre Dame's defense should hit the ground running this year.
Yeah, what they returned and what he knew about them, what he knows about them now compared to back in August is staggering difference probably. He's even mentioned it not talking at the highest level, but remember when I asked him about Ko Okia and he joked and said, well, if you would have asked me last year, I'd had no idea who that was, because he was basically, he was complimenting Kia, but he was also saying, like, I didn't know this roster.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't joking.
No. I'm saying, like, he didn't know the roster last year because he couldn't. No. And let's not absolve him from things. There was some weird stuff. Like, whatever they saw that Carson Hobbs should play more against Miami than Devonta Smith is they saw something wrong. They misevaluated it.
Yep. It happens. I mean, yeah, we were talking about Joe Rudolph. Like, he misevaluated Sam Pendleton a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You know? It happens.
But yeah, I would go the same thing. We all believe there's the drop-off is coming at running back, but I think they'll be successful. Really, Tim, that's a great point. B, it leads to A more than it leads to CJ Carr being in jeopardy.
Yeah, I think CJ Carr will be able to protect himself as well.
Yeah. That's true. He's not. Yeah, actually, he'll probably be high level at that.
We have a question from CMU Pens fan. And the question is, the Miami game this year will have to have the feel of there will be blood from the crowd. Since the end of the Holtz era, could you name similar games where the Notre Dame crowd came with a hostile attitude toward the visitors?
I quickly thought of Michigan when they were going to stop playing in 2014 because it was the end of that series. And which made me think of USC in 2025 because they were going to stop playing. Those were two special reasons. And then go ahead, Pete, before I add more.
Yeah, those were, I thought of USC in 17, where it's just like you're just running roughshod over them. But I think that 2014 Michigan game is probably the most like, can you believe this is happening? This feels great from the Notre Dame like fan base. Also, I'm going to flip you the double bird on the when did you walk back up the tunnel. So I think the Miami one probably will surpass that though.
Oh yeah.
And it's such a weird dynamic because I don't get the sense from the players at all that this is like, oh, I mean, it's a big game, but not like, oh, I hate Miami. I mean, the players are just like, whatever, it's a game. Like, they're good. It should be fun. Whereas I think the crowd itself is just going to be completely venomous.
It can only be, like, there's only a few teams that this could be.
Great, yeah.
Michigan being one, Miami certainly being another, and then I guess USC and Clemson. I don't know who else.
You know, Ohio State, Hartman year.
Yeah.
Pretty darn impressed. The crowd was, it was more like a desperate crowd, wasn't it? They were just desperate to win that game.
I don't think they really believed what they were watching. And it was like, holy crap, they might win. And they didn't.
That was a devastating loss. I mean, when you're that close. I mentioned I talked to Jack Kaiser recently, and he said, we should have beat Ohio State twice. Well, you should have beat them once. I know that for sure.
What's the
I
don't second
know.
One?
Well, that's a defensive captain, you know, with his emotions talking about the national championship game. But yeah, well, this will be, for two reasons. This will be probably unlike anything. One, because everything that transpired last year, losing to Miami, and then everything that transpired after that. And two, because it's Miami, because of the history that you have with them. So it's a perfect crash course here.
Caleb Williams, 23, was fun for Notre Dame fans. And because he lit him up the year before, returned as a Heisman winner. But I think the loss the week before to Louisville might have just stemmed the tide going into the game. And then the party started during the game.
What? Not to get gallows about this, but worst loss, Notre Dame loses at home to Miami this fall, or 2011 USC. I mean, I think it would be in that
the faceplant game where they just everything went wrong.
You're just like it would just be intolerable as a loss.
This would be worse.
This would be worse.
This would be worse.
Notre Dame. Yeah, because Notre Dame's better. I mean, with the state of the program is way better than it was. And I hear what you're saying, but I mean, the state of the program is so far along. That's why people keep talking about, well, the slow starts. And I get that. I mean, that's history. That's fact. I'm not concerned about Notre Dame because of what happened against Northern Illinois and previously. I don't think that's going to be a factor anymore. Although, I did underrate the Wisconsin quarterback, the kid that came from Old Dominion. I saw a little bit of him. I think I did underestimate him in the rankings a little bit. Not that I think Wisconsin's going to upset Notre Dame, but they'll bring a little bit of defense, and Notre Dame's offense may not or probably won't be clicking on all cylinders in the opener.
I was just thinking, you know, you can say Wisconsin's quarterback can challenge Notre Dame, but he probably has a few thoughts as to how Notre Dame's secondary might challenge him and his wide receivers.
Everything is superseded by, oh my God, look who's on the other side of the ball.
This was 2008. You'd be like, yeah, this could be a problem against this quarterback, but maybe not so much in 26.
It doesn't matter if he's living or breathing. By the end of the game, it might not be either.
But I do think that, you know, if like we talked about the offensive line, if it's not clicking or, you know, the car hasn't developed a chemistry with the wide receivers, I could see the offense starting a little bit slowly against the Wisconsin. The issue there is, though, that Notre Dame's opponents early on are essentially very poor. So you know, Notre Dame should be able to overcome that.
Next question from PQ. What it do what? What is something you deem necessary for Notre Dame to win the title that you're currently least confident they have?
Pete, go ahead.
Receiver. I'm not there with that position group. I think they could be good. I'm not saying you have to be great, like elite killer at wide receiver to win a national title. I don't think Ohio State definitely had them. Indiana did not have like a killer at wide receiver last year, but especially without Love and Press, like you have somebody who can go up and just win a 50-50 when you really need it that breaks the other team's back. And just not sure Notre Dame has that right now.
I would agree. But I don't think it's a skill issue. I just think it's a development chemistry issue if it happens early on in the season. You still short yardage. You still probably can't do it with your quarterback like you, Tim.
He doesn't want to,
or they don't want to.
Probably both. A little bit of both. I mean, he wants to more than they want to, I think. I'm sure CJ Carr would take on anything like that, but he's the one that brought him back against Miami running up the middle to score the touchdown and to convert.
But I think, Mylon Graham's going to be good, but he's not there yet because he hasn't proven it. We haven't seen Quincy Porter. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing him in person in a Notre Dame uniform. I think the talent is there. I think the chemistry needs to be developed, and you can throw all summer and you can throw all preseason, but you have to be able to do it in the game. And I'm not sure, like Pete said, I'm not sure that they'll be ready out of the gate. But again, the schedule's forgiving enough that I think that chemistry can be built during the first half of the season when you have mostly games that you should win by a substantial amount.
I think Pete touched on it in his answer, but I'm not just saying wide receiver, just the overall loss of the most explosive two players they've had in years. Plus Malachi Fields was 3 or 4. On that team for explosiveness. Jordan Faison would be the other one. So you lost 3 of your best 4 most explosive guys. You replaced them with good in Aeneas Williams, probably good in Quincy Porter, hopefully really good in Mylon Graham. You didn't come close to replacing what Jeremiah Love did for you. I think that they're like the only team that didn't need great receivers because they had him at running back. They had the 60-yard throw at running back.
That's a good way.
People.
You know, don't you think? I think Notre Dame fans were more confident in Aeneas Williams before Love became Superman. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I think I feel that way.
I think Aeneas Williams is going to have a very good season. It'll just come in a different form.
Just a little different. He was Love. I mean, every time I talked about Love, like on any show, they're like, well, tell me about Jeremiah Love. I'm like, how long do you have? Because this is the person I want to talk about more than anyone I could ever think of. It was a different world. And also on that note, before the Georgia, Penn State, and Ohio State games, I'm like, I don't know if they're going to be able to run the ball because that dude was amazing and he's hurt. Like, we knew he was re-injured, after that IU run. He was just such a difference maker. And now I'm just talking about Jeremiah Love like he's Will Fuller at Pittsburgh and Pete Sampson's making fun of me again. So. Next question from Schweib43. As we're entering the second season of recruiting to 105-man roster limits, what are some early takeaways from the way you see ND recruit positions or stack depth as opposed to the 85-man days?
Well, I think the depth, you have 20 offensive linemen on scholarship, but you're always going to have a bunch there. 13 defensive tackles, I think that's probably where it shows up the most on defense and on offense. Wide receivers.
Yeah, 15 receivers.
It's just an incredible amount to see running around, out there at a single practice. We haven't seen that before.
Yeah, I don't know if I asked Freeman or Kelly about this, but it's just like sort of how the numbers shifted over time. And it was like, all right, sign an extra corner, sign an extra rush, and sign an extra offensive lineman. And now it's like you can kind of get 1.5 each. Both, like I think last year's 6-man offensive line class, I'm not saying they're going to do that every year, but they're not going to have any 4-man offensive line classes, I don't think. I think you're averaging 11 in a 2-year window. DBs, they can oversign there too. I think they've done a great job with that. So, yeah, I think it's just getting extra guys.
Yeah, and you have to plan for attrition a little bit more now. You didn't used to lose many linemen, but now, you have to evaluate them by year 2, and mm-hmm. they might want to play somewhere else.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have a more experienced DN thrown into the equation.
Right. Yeah.
But that's where Keon Keeley and Rodney Dunham come in play.
I mean, it's a cool question because they went out and got Jaden Sanders and DJ McKinney at their best position. That's a strange.
And they needed them. None of us really thought they needed them necessarily at the time, right?
At the time, no. And then all of a sudden.
But they were right.
Turns out, sometimes those things work out well. We should mention that.
We have a question from Maltese Irish. T.O., please amuse us. I don't know if that I can.
Came from musings.
Okay, no, I got you. But I don't know if I can accurately portray what I'm reading to the people listening. But anyway, yes. we must know about the massive Van Gorder misspeak regarding Tony Springman and why Troy Nicholas leaving early was to he stands chagrin.
So I will do the he stand part and you guys chime in. But Pete, I am going to prompt you for the appropriate answer with the Tony Springman. Are you prepared?
All right. Yes.
Pete Sampson will be playing the role of Brian Van Gorder. Upstairs, Isbin Auditorium. I believe I'll be playing J.J. Stankiewicz, who asked the question, right? Is that who it was?
Now of the Indianapolis Colts.
Now of the Indianapolis Colts. Coach Van Gorder, what have you seen from Tony Springman coming back from injury?
Tony Springman?
That was all we needed to know about who Tony Springman was, a player for real on the 2012 as a redshirt freshman, really good D, backup at defensive end. Never really got to play much again at Notre Dame, but that was how much Brian Van Gorder knew about what we viewed as a potential backup X factor on the 2014 line.
And I don't know, like, if he had seen the film, he would have been impressed by Tony Springman.
Well, but we knew he wasn't playing.
Right.
Anything about him.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. He was injured and unavailable. And that was
like major that was back surgery, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. He had major back surgery.
Yeah.
He was legit. I mean, if you go watch some of the old 2012 highlights, he popped up like four.
He was
five
long. Well, that's why it was interesting when they put him in the middle, because he was long and he could do some things in there, even though he certainly wasn't a prototypical interior defensive lineman.
Brian Kelly on the cutting edge there, as you can see. And then the other part was just really funny. Troy Nicholas, we all love.
It just pissed off Hestand.
Yeah, Hestand. Well, Nicholas said something like, I have to go now because I have to be concerned about my second contract. To which Hestand said, he doesn't know any of the plays, but he's worried about his second contract. An absolutely fantastic comment.
But, well, he knew that Troy Nicholas could help his offensive line out a little bit.
Oh yeah, he was just bitter.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are good days when you find those out. But yeah, the Tony Springman one, the imitation Pete, that's well done. I had to save that one for you for a couple of weeks. It was sitting up here.
Oh, so good.
Our next question from Tally Alley. This is an intriguing one too. With the NIL era, are high school verbal pledges more sticky compared to the pre-NIL era? Due to contract languages or anything having to do with the NIL payments. So in my other words, will we see many decommits from top tier players? Because you assume those are the guys that are signing NIL deals like you always did in the past. Speaking of the Springman era with Lynch and Tuitt and all those guys going back and forth.
Pete, go ahead.
I think you'll see it a lot less. I don't think it would eliminate it because there's nothing to stop somebody else from just offering more NIL money. But like a lot of these guys, I don't know what percentage of players just sign with the team or commit to the team with the biggest NIL package, but it's probably a decent amount. And so those guys are set where they're going. There's a decent amount of guys who just like the school or like the coach. You know, it's as well capitalized as Notre Dame is from an NIL point of view, they're also incredibly fortunate to have Marcus Freeman as the head coach. So you have those two things working together. I think you're going to have a stickier recruiting class, but That doesn't mean that it's going to be locked down. I think you could make an argument that the back end of the recruiting class might be more susceptible to have guys drop out because they're not making a lot of money. And then maybe a mid-level Big Ten team comes in and is like, hey, you know, we can pay you $100,000 more because, you know, we think you're our level kind of player and we can build the program around you. Whereas at Notre Dame or Georgia or Ohio State, you're sitting the bench for 3 to 4 years. So that might be where the verbal commitments are less sticky than before. I don't know.
Yeah, as long as there's a school out there that's willing to spend more, then, you know, that can happen. But the old verbal commitment has largely been replaced by a business transaction. It's not just, hey, I'm coming there. It's a business deal worked out by both sides, and the high school player has representation, and so it's very different, and it is closer to a business transaction than the old verbal commitment. But, you know, if Texas Tech wants somebody, they're not going to stop upping their offer. You know, Nick, I was going to say Nick Marsh. I mean, that's the transfer portal, which is a little bit different, but right. You know, yeah, it's closer to an actual business agreement, because there are financial repercussions discussed when that decision is made.
And I don't think, I did a quick look because you can't always remember the non-famous decommits, but like Keon Keeley's year, there's different reasons for it, but NIL was involved in 2023, not for Notre Dame recruiting yet, but others. Keon Keeley decommit, Peyton Bowen decommit, Brandon Hillman was different, that wasn't NIL. Elijah Page, Dylan Edwards, and some other guys like Cedric Irvin and Justin Rett were also different. They were partly due to Notre Dame. 2025, because last year there were none, right? There were none last year in that class. 2025 had seven, Deuce Knight being the famous one. And of course, Notre Dame parts ways with some guys like Anderson and Thurman. Ivan Taylor was on that list. They're better protected against that, Pete, to your point. I think the bottom, you'll get decommits, I think. I think zero is an anomaly. You'll get a couple at the bottom of the roster because they just see more opportunity elsewhere. And you can't blame them. If you're a corner coming to Notre Dame and you're not that good, and they bring in McKinney and Sanders and have Zachary and Golden and Moore and Gray, it's like, I don't know. Maybe this is not the spot for me anymore, because they're clearly trying to recruit over those guys. And they weren't capable of recruiting over those guys at certain positions back in the past.
Yeah.
Our final question, and East Text 903 is a very good submitter of questions. He is not happy about the Miami praise. I'm a little surprised by how much praise Cristobal and Miami have been getting on the recent podcasts, but it raises a bigger question. What is that November matchup going to look like in the schedule as a result if the Canes enter with one or two losses? And really for Notre Dame, let's answer that part first.
Well, I mean, what praise have we been there?
I loved the way Cristobal's lines – I thought when you have an offensive and defensive line-driven program, I thought that's why they beat Notre Dame last year, and that's what carried them to almost being able to beat Indiana. Also, Malachi Toney.
Well, that's a football observation. That's not like making up praise for – they had one of the most dominant defenses in the country, and they're still going to be pretty good on that side of the ball. I just don't – Miami's still pretty good, and they played for the national title. I mean, I don't know what to say about that exactly.
I think the argument on the board was that it was the players that they brought in the portal and the offensive linemen, maybe more than the culture of Cristobal's offensive.
And they
that's part of coaching.
Yeah.
And they have the best transfer portal group among any of Notre Dame's opponents this year.
I think Mario Cristobal has done a phenomenal job at Miami. If you look back to what Miami was before he got there, and then how much work it took to get to Miami to make it look like it looked last year. I mean, the program was a dumpster fire, culturally, just a hot mess. And I think he's done an incredible job of taking a very old school approach and putting his stamp on that program there that seemed unstampable. Like, that was just like, no, we're just going to run around and be flashy, and we're going to be super fast and soft, and we're going to show up to the Sun Bowl wearing snow gear because there's snow on the ground. Now they're tough, and they still have some very fast guys. But, man, I think he's done a phenomenal job on both lines, and it's like they built the program. What I think – I was at ACC meetings and talked to somebody from Miami, and I was just like, are Marcus and Mario friends at all? Because we were joking around about Pat McAfee saying, like, they should fight. I feel like Marcus and Mario see football the same way. And, like, if they would get along if they were at a coach's convention, because they're just more, like, all-ball type coaches.
Yeah, I don't think Cristobal's a great game day coach. You know, anything we say, I don't think he's necessarily a great game day coach. And yet, you know, we talk with Notre Dame, we talk about culture, I think, and what Pete's saying. He has finally found a way to mesh what Miami wants to be, you know, flashy and what have you, with the culture that you need at a place like Miami. That's what I respect him for. Not necessarily his decision making on game day, because I think that he's made some mistakes along the way, you know. But is he a great coach? If you get your guys to play for you, you're a very good coach. Yeah.
It was loosely related, but he added, and this is, I think he's saying, if that, you know, if Miami comes in with a loss or two here.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even address
it. Has a recent national champion finished with a strength of schedule outside the top 40? I think Notre Dame could be in trouble for that if Miami has a loss. But if SMU has two losses, Miami has a loss. The hard thing about looking these up, and I started to do it too late in the process, is it includes your playoff runs. So Indiana had the hardest schedule in the country last year, which is funny because they did not have the hardest schedule in the country last year. You know what? When you play in the Big Ten championship game with Ohio State and then you get Alabama and Oregon and Miami, your schedule gets a lot harder as it turns out, and you win all those games. Like Notre Dame got nuts in 2024. Their schedule went crazy when they started playing in the playoffs.
Yeah, just like the inclusion of a conference championship game would make this impossible to view from Notre Dame's point of view, because you're right. I mean, Indiana's schedule was like, I mean, non-conference was awful, but winning at Oregon is impressive. You know, winning at Penn State, that's a good win.
Well, it's also,
but then beating Ohio State in Indianapolis is incredible.
Yeah, the Penn State one is also, I like to put that in the category of what Notre Dame kind of faces once in a while with Clemson. Like, it's not their fault Penn State went into the downward spiral.
Right.
You know, that's...
Yeah, I mean, they had a tough game at Iowa. Like, Iowa was... They're pretty good. That's a hard place to go.
I took a quick look, and similar to Indiana, like Michigan 2023, because you can just throw out the SEC. They have the SEC championship games and then you're going to play Alabama or Georgia. Michigan 2023, similar to Indiana last year, had East Carolina, UNLV, Bowling Green, Rutgers. It is your fault for playing Rutgers. I don't care if they're in your conference. That's why conferences are dumb.
It's your fault.
Yeah. Nebraska, Minnesota, Red Indiana, back when they stunk. Michigan State, horrible. Purdue, Red Purdue. Penn State was good. Maryland, who played them close. But then you finish with Ohio State. You have to play the Big Ten championship game. You draw Alabama and you draw Washington. So it's not like you didn't beat anybody, but you sure did get to coast until some of those more important games. So I think you find that once in a while. But it doesn't matter now if you play three or four championship games, basically, once you're in the playoffs. It becomes difficult. I don't know if that means people aren't going to schedule Texas, Ohio State type games and Notre Dame, Texas type games. If that stinks, because pretty sure that's my favorite part of the sport, is when you watch those teams play in September, October, and November, really.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, I can understand why somebody doesn't want to open with a game like that.
Yes, that
you know,
Notre Dame was penalized for opening with that game, and people were actually made to go back and watch it for some reason in the room to knock them out.
Like Miami was rewarded. So it's like, this is the point of sports. The winner is rewarded and the loser is penalized.
Well, no. Not if you go for it on 4th and 2 against your sub-500 rival, you're not penalized. And if you lose...
Excluding Alabama from this conversation.
Okay, good. Exclude Alabama. Because if you lose to the really bad Florida State team, nobody should go back to that. No one should go watch that game. It was early.
Which leads us back to the original. Notre Dame could have won the national title. And Alabama and Oklahoma, two playoff teams, in addition to the group of five teams, had no chance of doing that.
We ended on a happy note once again, right there. We will be back on Thursday. It was somewhat happy, just that Notre Dame deserved it. We'll be back on Thursday, June 4th, I believe that is. For Pete Sams of The Athletic, Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thanks for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.